Hello and welcome to the Beyond Shakespeare podcast. And today's discussion show, we're going to be discussing a production from the past, from the before times of the play Supposes by George Gascoigne. And if you've been watching us on our YouTube channel, you will know that we have had a bit of a glut of George, gorgeous George, over the last few months, having done a very rough first read through of the texts. But today we are able to talk to people who have not only produced a video that exists online of a performance, but have gone through the whole process of actually making that show come alive for real audiences today. And the wonderful people in the room I have with me are...
Hello, I'm Sam Plum. I am a theatre maker. I live in Cambridge. I do quite a lot of work in youth theatre.
And...
Hello, my name is Rhianna White. I'm currently a student and an aspiring actress, theatre maker.
And I'm your host, Robert Crichton. Just mentioning that again, if it is indeed again, because sometimes I forget to actually introduce who I am. I have the advantage I can always re-record these links later if they sound really, really silly. So, Supposes by George Gascoigne. I'll ask Sam first, because I know he's going to be really up for talking about the play itself. Can you tell us something about the play? What drew you to the play, as well as what is the play? What is a suppose?
Right, well, a suppose, I think, is a conceit, an imagining, a kind of a bit of gossip, something which catches everyone's attention and draws them into the same story. So and that's quite appropriate, I suppose, for a farce which is full of stories being misheard and told about other groups, which is kind of what happens a lot in this play. So I heard about this play from a guy called James McBain, who was at the time part of an organisation called Early Drama at Oxford, which is the brainchild of James McBain and Elizabeth Dutton. And they wanted a young company to do a production of this play. And so they came to me because they knew I was directing a youth theatre group in which Rhianna was a young member then, which is my drama school. It's all so sad. Times have changed, but it's wonderful as well. And so, yeah, we did this play. Do you want me to attempt a really speedy plot summary?
Oh, I'd love you to attempt a speedy plot summary.
Okay, I might get some things wrong, and I'm sorry about that. So many years before the start of the play, Cleander, who is a rich and stingy man and a sort of merchant, loses his wife and infant son in a shipwreck. 2 years before the start of the play, a student called Erostrato has arrived in Ferrara and fallen in love with Polynesta and swapped identities with his servant Dilippo in order to take up a serving job at Polynesta's house so that he can woo her. Meanwhile, Dilippo, his servant, lives the life of a master of a student and sort of wanders around Ferrara with loads of servants. Then you're in the play itself. And the lovers are now getting quite tetchy because for 2 years they've been keeping this secret. So the first thing that happens is that Polynesta tells her nurse about who this serving man really is. And of course he's in fact a student and her lover, unbeknownst to her father. Meanwhile, Cleander is important. He is now an old rich man and he's trying to woo for the hand of Polynesta. And Polynesta's father, Damon, seems inclined to accept. So basically what happens then is a bunch of hijinks to prevent Polynesta being given to Damon. So Erostrato, still in disguise, gets his mischievous servant, who's in disguise as him, to also woo Polynesta, which means that his mischievous servant needs a father figure to say that he backs this proposal with financial backing and moral backing. So he finds a foolish traveller to pretend to be his father. Cue lots of farce around this foolish traveller having to be convinced that because he's in Ferrara, he's actually hunted, so he has to take on a new identity. Unfortunately, Erostrato's real father also turns up to visit during this sequence, and there's this sort of locked out of the house thing where Erostrato's real father isn't allowed into Erostrato's house, and Erostrato's house is manned by Erostrato's servant. So what is going on? Is there some kind of a conspiracy? And then there are lots of other mischievous servants and lower status characters getting involved. There's passive Philo, who is a parasite of Cleander, who basically just wants a good meal and sometimes carries messages to try to achieve this. There's Polynesta's nurse, Abalia, who I mentioned earlier, and her gossip friend, who is called an old hag in the dramatis personae, who are in on some of the secrets and are sort of leaky vessels spreading rumours and confusion. And then there are a few scurrilous comic working class characters working for Erostrato who have names like Crappino. And eventually all is resolved by the revelation that Cleander's long lost son is Gilippo, the servant of Erostrato. So this means that Cleander is happy without marrying Polynesta, and her father Damon is happy to accept Erostrato as his son-in-law now that Erostrato's real father has shown up and proven to be honourable. So it's a farce with lots of storytelling on stage. Lots of, I did this, I've dressed up as this, I know you should dress up as this. A lot of stuff happens off stage, so you have to be quite on top of the words.
Yes, and this is an excellent précis, by the way, because it's a difficult play to describe because it's sort of stuff happens. When we were doing the read through, we did it over three sessions and some people weren't there for the first session. So we were trying to explain the story so far. Just there's some stuff. Just get on board, you'll be fine. So this is a play from around 1566. It was produced at the Inns of Court, the Gray's Inn. So a suitably young bunch of people. So Rhianna, you were one of those young bunch. How did Sam introduce you to this text? What did you think of this text when you first saw it or heard that this was going to happen?
I was a part of the production that we did previously, which was Jack Drum's Entertainment. So as far as I remember, when Supposes was brought to us as an idea, it was kind of like, we're doing another fun classical play, and that's kind of mostly what I remember, and just being on board because I had such a great time doing Jack Drum's Entertainment. It was fun to think that we could do a play that tackles text and farce and had room for character comedy, which is all things that as a group we grew to really love through doing the previous show and also wanted to work on. So it was kind of like a way to progress as well. I remember being, I think, overwhelmed at first by the plot. I think I still am. And I think, yeah, we spent a long time trying to unpick that and get a real sense of your personal character's journey before even trying to figure out everyone else's as well.
Yeah, it can be a moderately intimidating text because, you know, it is this, it's in prose. It's, you know, our earliest full prose work that we have in English. There may be lost ones that Gascoigne has translated this text and made it into this thing that can be a bit intimidating, especially when you've got people who are pretending to be different people, but who, depending on which script version of the script you have, the name that your character has is the name of the person that they're not. It's not presented as a text necessarily in the best way to make actors or producers go, oh, I really want to do this text, which is why having recordings of things makes such a difference. So, having chosen the play, Sam, how do you move it towards production?
Yes, well, it was very fortunate that we'd already done an old play because the cast mostly had some experience of the language, as we like to say in the modern theatre. The language, it's all about the language, darling. but of course, they hadn't done a prose play, and they hadn't worked with a play that is kind of its main stylistic device on a language level is alliteration. So they hadn't had to work with alliteration like that. And these speeches are enormous. They are so big. I felt so sorry for Harry, who was playing our Erostrato, because he just had like 2-page-long speeches. And so did Tom, who was playing our Damon. Enormous speeches, which were quite shapeless, were it not for the alliteration. So that was challenging. But what I did was two main things. The first one, very, very simple, changed all the names, which might be a sacrilegious, irreverent choice, but it's a confusing play and we were actually going to do it and people were actually going to watch it. So I needed to make sure they understood it so they could laugh at it. So I modernized all the names to things we would recognize because I figured modern audiences won't instantly go, oh, Erostrato, he's a lover and things like that. And then that kind of went hand in hand with changing the locations. So because we were performing it first and foremost in Cambridge, we changed the locations to Cambridge, Peterborough, London and Brighton, and had this sort of network of locations we could do in jokes about. And that allowed for options with improv, some of which we took up. We had this song whenever Brighton was mentioned that went, "Brighton, Brighton, a very bright town," which didn't in the end, I think, happen in the play, but it provided a lot of laughs through rehearsals. It was very immature.
Yeah, I was just going to say, because Sam, I've worked with you. I've been your lighting designer a few times, yeah. So I have an idea of how you work, and you know, communicating that to the audience at home. You know, there's an awful lot of playfulness in the room, and yeah, the games where that comes in. I was going to say, Rihanna, did you have any horrid speeches and your character? Actually, I don't know if I've asked you what your character was and what was their original name and what was the name you ended up with. Did you let them choose their own names, or did you choose?
Yeah, that was democratically done. And can I just slip in? So we changed the names and we did that democratically. And the second thing was I basically did like half of every rehearsal was improv. It had nothing to do with the play, which was to do with building a good vibe, but also making like upping their comic timing. And that, I thought that really paid off. But yes, Rihanna, you were.
So I played the character Cleander, who is the lawyer that's trying to woo Polynestra and trying to find his lost son. And his name, when we updated it to 1950s Camden, then became Quentin Quincy, which I will always be fond of. I love that name. I think it's so silly. what else
did you have? You had a fake beard.
Fake beard.
Did you have any long speeches?
Did I have any long speeches? I didn't have any speeches that were as long as the ones mentioned for the characters of Damon, etc.
Yeah, some people have speeches which are sort of storytelling and almost stand-up material, and some people are more engaged in the action. Were you more, your character more engaged in the action, I think?
Yeah, he was. And it was more sort of, if he did have a paragraph, it was kind of him being angry or him having a sort of crisis about his masculinity or him talking about the details of when he lost his son. And they were all kind of quite self-indulgent, which also meant they were fun to play with. But they were, quite involved in the action. I didn't have to address the audience directly at any point, I don't think.
So in terms of the text, I mean, it's a chunky old bit of text. Did you do much in the way of cutting, adaptation, as it were? Or how much were you able to let the text speak for itself?
Well, I was trying to serve the needs of early drama at Oxford. I didn't want to completely appropriate the play. I wanted to, because one of the things they're keen on is you're doing this text with a sort of analogous cast, so with a young cast, in analogous spaces. So we were performing in historical space. I'm sure we'll talk about that later. But I was trying to not mess the text up, but also, you know, I was trying to fill it and drop in. And so to begin with, I cut very little, but then we did our first performance, and Rihanna will remember this, and after our first performance, I like halved all the speeches, all the big chunky speeches. I should have done that long before. I was learning on the job. I was learning on the job, all right. But the second show was much tighter, and I think that modern companies would find they can do without a lot of the long speeches. A lot of the dialogue is very, very nice, and there's nothing wrong with the long speeches, but at the same time, I'm not really sure what they're doing. I think you do need an audience that has really bought into those stock characters, has seen them time and time again on the student university stage, and is willing to see your mates really clown it up and milk playing the, you know, the angry, depressed father, or playing the lost lover who's with a mischievous servant. And it just felt like our audience was not in that genre in the same way. They, you know, they want something snappy, and fast for us these days is much snappier.
How much rehearsal time did you have? And before you get to your first performances, and we'll talk a bit more about how the performances were managed in a moment, but you know, you've got a rehearsal process. But yeah, how long did you have, and what were you able to do with that time? Because sometimes these things can, you know, crunch down to quite a small period of time, or was it quite long?
Well, these days I am much more efficient, and I feel as a director. But 4 years ago, I felt like I was cramming loads into our process, and it was it, I'd say an awful lot of the process was devoted to just improvising and building a company. And I look back on this show and I think that those performers, we had 12 performers, that was that one of the happiest casts I've ever had. They got on so well by the end of it. So I do think that time was well used in those regards. And I think that energy was readable from the audience, that supportiveness. But the way we did it was, so we started rehearsing in September and the first show was in March. So we rehearsed every Saturday in term time. That's the way that organisation works, 10 a.m. till 5 p.m. But in reality, I wouldn't say we got 6 or 7 solid hours of focused work every Saturday. We did a lot of playing, a lot of silly drama games, a lot of improv games, a lot of stuff that had nothing to do with the play. And then we'd be like, oh, we've got to learn our lines. Because one thing that's really convenient about this show, and a reason that I do think it's a doable show, and it's also a funny show, is that it's made up of duologues. So you can do partial rehearsing with it, which is nice. So I'd have a group of 12 and often I would just split them into groups and then I would sort of roam between the groups and they would work up their own scenes together. So you can do quite a lot like that and make quite a lot of progress if you're willing to do simultaneous rehearsals of little segments. And then we performed in March and in April. We performed a few performances at the Mumford Theatre in Cambridge, which is a student theatre as part of Anglia Ruskin University, which is a massive stage. And we had 2 big doors and a proper kind of farce set, which we were really proud of, and a big red curtain. So we could do the farce thing. And then we used the doors built into Queen's College, Cambridge Dining Hall, which is an Elizabethan dining hall, and a space like the ones in which the play would originally have been performed. So those 2 doors the students go in to dine in, and the long tables, that was our set, and we had people sat on those long tables. That felt very different. And then Queen's College, Oxford, similarly, we used their doors. In fact, weirdly, the first half of that show was performed outdoors as like a kind of alfresco performance with a fake door, and then, you know, with a prop door, and then we performed indoors with the doors that were like the site specific doors, if you will. So it was a real range.
Go back to the rehearsals, Rihanna, you know, how was that process for you and finding the show, and that, again, that development of rehearsing the show, the difference in finding it before you actually get to it to an audience?
I think a lot of it started off with research into the language and really getting our head around the plot. And then when we relocated it to the 1950s, it was fun to figure out all the different contexts and make sure that all lined up as well. So it was kind of like learning the original plot and then almost relearning it. But that definitely helped and made it more relevant for us, and also gave us kind of more license to play with it, because it was then in a world we understood and could have fun with. I'm recalling playing a lot of games and, yeah, really coming together as a cast. I think sometimes we would, as Sam said, a lot of the scenes are duologues. So I remember with my scenes, I would go off and sometimes we would just try and come up with our own blocking to start with and then come back and show you. Is this correct, Sam? I'm having memories of this.
Yeah, I think
I hope
so.
I didn't dream this up.
No, I think you're right. It's hilarious. And also, I completely forgot to mention the whole 1950s thing. So this just shows, I don't want it to sound like all of this was planned. It was really interesting working on this show, because I was really learning how to direct, and it was a great show to do that on. The first 2 months of rehearsals, the book I'd read before rehearsals, really stupidly, was that Katie Mitchell book about directing. You know, it's like called The Art of Directing or something. I don't know, I've got it somewhere. Obviously, why would I have chosen to read that book? She's fantastic, but it has nothing to do with working on Renaissance farce and, you know, serious kind of naturalism and serious kind of like application of Stanislavski. So I'd read this book, and so I was convinced for the first 2 months we were going to use the original names. It would really work if it was set in Ferrara. And we just had to research. We just had to get really into the location. And then, you know, I couldn't help the fact that inside all I want to do is play improv games. So it wasn't too serious or rigorous. And I remember coming out of one rehearsal, about 2 months in, but in reality only about 6 or 7 rehearsals in because of how spread out rehearsals are, and going to the pub and just opening up my laptop and kind of doing an adaptation of the script where I changed the locations and experimented with changing some of the language so that instead of being a student and a servant, they became a musician and the musician's roadie. And then I wanted it to have a world. It felt like it needed a world that we could see as being comical, but also a world with threat. So kind of like 1950s, like music venue, competitive London and Cambridge was what I came up with in the pub. And we stuck to it and it was great. And we ended up having a 1950s soundtrack and there was a guitar case that was never opened, suggesting like that. It was suggestive. But I think, we could have developed more. But yeah, that's right. That was a whole aspect of it.
Well, that's the thing is when you're working with people and you're working over a, okay, the rehearsal period itself is very small chunks, but you're working over a long period of time, you can actually engage with the text and play around. And it's not like you've turned up and going, right, I'm setting this whole play in a bathhouse, or I'm going to do this. I'm going to, it's not like you're imposing in the same way. You're playing around and finding how things work.
Right. And I think that's a real, a real virtue of having a long rehearsal process. Someone said to me once, when I was really new to directing old plays, try everything. If there's a Morris dance, try the Morris dance. If there's a sword fight, try the sword fight. Don't cut things. Don't come in there with your modern expectations because you might find it's doing something you didn't realize it was doing. And so I'm glad that I tried to do the whole text and I tried to keep it where it was because I think that was the most organic way of doing it. And I do think the cast were with me. By the time we arrived with this 1950s concept, everyone was like, oh, this is much better. Now we can really belong in this play.
Well, that's the thing, you can let the play breathe. Did you feel that, Rihanna, with that process of journeying from, very strict application of text to something a little freer?
Yeah, definitely. I think I probably felt a sense of relief when we came to the 1950s, dear. I do remember the research thing being quite overwhelming and potentially intense. I think at some point looking through my notes and scripts, I found like a map that you'd made of where Ferrara would have been in reference. And like, okay, guys, so this would have been roughly 3 kilometres north. So you need to think about your character doing this. And I was just how intense actor research can sometimes be. So for a youth company, that can be quite overwhelming. So to be able to kind of not have to delve so far into the past in order to find answers for your character was definitely a relief.
I remember Jacob was really relieved that he didn't have to be called Crappino anymore. He could change it. He was so annoyed he was called Crappino.
But that's the name I'd keep.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a fantastic name, isn't it? It just, once it was set in London, it's Crappino. I mean, it is a great name. It's just a joke, isn't it?
Yeah. So you've been rehearsing, you're heading towards first performance in Cambridge. How does that first performance go? What's that like for you as a performer? You have the audience response. You're getting an audience response for the first time. What's the difference between the thing you're rehearsing and the thing that actually gets performed?
I mean, that's always just the best part, isn't it? Is just chucking it in front of an audience and going, what happens now? And really having to think on your feet. And then the flip side of that is the next time you perform, how you can learn from that. So I think the first time is always like the most daunting and exciting. Looking back at my memory of the performances we did after the first one, which was in Cambridge at the Mumford Theatre, I think they were better and we grew more comfortable in playing with the audience, playing with our characters and kind of then mess with it more. The first time you're almost a bit more apprehensive about how much license do I have over this thing that we've made, because you want to do it as you rehearsed it. But yeah, obviously it feels good when people laugh at things that you meant to be funny, and less so when they don't.
I mean, but just to say, the audience did laugh, just checking.
They did laugh.
Oh, they did.
Oh, no. They did laugh.
Yeah. Can I just to sort of wedge in there? I was really pleased with how all of the performances went, but I think they were all really different. And I think so. We did this thing with the opening. There's this prologue, which is just an extended pun on the words suppose and supposes. These are supposes. I suppose you shall suppose that these are supposes, and blah blah blah. And it's spoken by a prologue. And we didn't know who was going to speak it for a while, and then we decided it would be spoken by the father of Polynesta, Damon, and that we would treat the opening as the kind of the father of the bride speech at the wedding of Polynesta and Erostrato, on the grounds that we didn't think that was going to give too much away. It's not really a spoiler, I think, in a romantic farce that the lovers do get together. So we had him come out in front of a red curtain and stand in front of a lectern and do this speech. And we had all the cast sat in the audience in their costume. So for the whole, as the audience were coming in, they were mingling with them in character, and that's where I really felt pleased and relaxed and proud of them, that we'd done all this improv work and they were just very comfortable doing a youth theatre version of immersive, and you could already feel the audience were relaxing and going, oh, this is unusual. We were expecting this to be all highbrow and academic, and they're just mingling with us, just chatting away, and they all have balloons. And then they let go of their balloons and they come on stage and they're about to kiss, and then they rewind, and then the play starts and the curtains draw back and reveal the set. And so, and from there on, like, it felt like we really had the audience. And I remember the moments that worked were moments, well, I mean, you know, obviously it's hard to say how do you know it worked, but moments where people laughed were the outrageous moments. So, and some of this is very much in the text. So Erostrato talking to Cleander, there's a moment where Erostrato decides to pretend to be someone else's servant and winds up Cleander with things that supposedly one of the gossips has been saying about, you know, that Pacifilo, the parasite, has been saying about Cleander. Anyway, and he says that one of the things that people have been saying about Cleander is that his balls are bursting. And that's in the script. And people were like slightly in hysterics about it because it's young people making these sort of smutty gags. And there's another bit when Erostrato changes his name to something very dirty. And we had to actually translate that. I think we translated it into suck my dick. Oh, they call me suck my dick, or something like that, because the original text had some joke that was exactly the same. It just wouldn't have been understood. I can't remember now what the original word was, but moments like that got like kind of they kind of got that gasp of hysteria which you're looking for. And other moments which I remember, I felt like there was a kind of web of magic being woven during those first performances, were when we kind of snuck in some flashbacks, because there's these long speeches where people are going, oh, this is how we met, or this is my poor wife, or this is what happened. And so we had this rule where we would try to act that out. So in the first scene, Polynesta is describing to her nurse Balia how she met Erostrato, and how Erostrato and Dilippo changed outfits in order to bring Erostrato closer to Polynesta, and we just kind of played that scene out under that monologue with a little bit of music in the background, and it felt like a film, and you saw them swapping outfits, and it's a classic trick, but it worked really well. And then once we'd established that, we then sort of started to undermine our own convention, because then later in the play, Damon is doing this monologue about, oh, his poor wife who's dead, and if only she were here, then Polynesta would have behaved and wouldn't be so weird and running off with all these men. And we actually had Rihanna present in this conversation in a massive veil, coming on as the ghost wife, and doing this really mad interpretive dance as the ghost wife with a young version of Polynesta under this speech. And things like that, those things went really well because the audience thought they'd understood a convention, knew that it was being modernised for them, and then saw that it was being pastiched before their eyes.
The dialogue that Gascoigne writes is sparkling. I mean, he really does know how to turn a line. You know, some of this is down to the play that it's translated from, but, you know, in terms of actually crafting dialogue, that for opening speech, that opening prologue, is really, really funny and very clever. And of course, you know, it's I don't know if it's difficult to learn, but once you've learned it, I suspect they'll never forget it.
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you're right. The dialogue is so well paced. It was just a dream.
Yeah, during the read through, we were finding that I underestimated how much text we could put in because they read it so quickly. They read the text about, you know, it was like watching a video on 1.5 speed. You know, it was, it just moves at such a wonderful pace. So you've done your first performance. There are other performances. How spread out is your tour, as it were? Is it all happening in a clump, or are there gaps? Do you need to re-rehearse in between? And what I'll go to Rihanna first. What do you remember about that process of doing it to different audiences, very different audiences as well? Did you find they reacted in very, depending on the context of who you were performing to?
So in the Mumford, I mean, so one of my character traits was that he had a terrible cough, couldn't like get through many sentences without starting a horrible, disgusting, vulgar coughing fit. And I remember, I think my first entrance, I kind of start coughing off stage and I was coming in via the auditorium stairs at the back. And I came in and started like basically nearly coughing on this guy who didn't really like it. Really just like kind of annoying the audience from get go. Obviously
these events, of course, occurred in the before times, before such things became much less socially acceptable. Just thought I'd put that disclaimer in. Apologise. Do continue.
No, thank you. Yeah, that's needed. But yeah, so it's, and I remember him not liking that. Whereas when I, which is fair enough. But we then performed it in Oxford, and the audience were a group of American students.
American summer school students.
Yeah, and they were lapping things like that up. They loved the vulgar jokes. Obviously, there's the stereotype that British people are a little bit more stiff upper lip, don't really like that kind of stuff. I think the Mumford definitely warmed up to my character. But yeah, the American audience were definitely more sort of like fits of giggles. They were drinking, they were eating. I mean, they were kind of like, the first half we had outside, some of them would like wander off in groups to go and get more Prosecco and then come back, which was definitely at first a bit baffling, but then kind of fun to play with and to notice when the people that were off getting Prosecco were also still kind of listening in, and when big physical jokes were happening, they were like, oh, what's going on? What did I miss? It's quite challenging as a performer to try and really still accommodate to an audience that is potentially quite distracted by alcohol being served. Yeah, and then the second half of that, when they were dining, when they were having their dinner, again playing with that and kind of almost standing on chairs over them as they were eating and really interrupting them, because it's like we didn't necessarily need to be there. They could quite happily chat to each other and have a drink and then eat their dinner. It was almost like we were interrupting their evening, which was a really fun idea to play up to and to just kind of get in the way as much as possible. And I'd never performed in a way like that at all. Yeah, so it was a really fun experience, definitely.
What was the sort of schedule of those performances? How spaced out were they, Sam? What were the logistics? Because that's what our audience is really interested in, is logistics.
Yeah, logistics. Oh, totally. Producer hats on, everyone. We did but two performances at the Mumford Theatre in Cambridge in late March. Then the following weekend, so a week later, we did one performance at Queen's College, Cambridge. And then the following weekend after that, we did one performance at Queen's College, Oxford. So it was four performances in total, spread over 3 weeks. And we didn't have any time, apart from on the coach to Oxford, to talk about the differences between those performances. And I mean, when we arrived to perform outside in Oxford, we were told that the students would all be standing. And I was just like, what? We're outside, there are no levels, there isn't a stage, there's just grass. They won't be able to see. There's a lot of action that takes place literally on the ground because it's farcical and people are falling over. So I just got the actors as part of their pre-show improv to get the audience to sit down on the grass and with their Prosecco. And so those were the logistics. I mean, all these performances were completely packed. I don't know how we did it. I mean, it was a really small cast, and I just made them to invite everyone they'd ever met. And then obviously the student performances at the Oxbridge colleges, they came with an in-house audience, so that we were very very lucky, as we like to say. And but they all had very different vibes, very, very positive. So the one in Cambridge at the actual theatre, as I say, we had a proper set, we had a proper PA system, a proper rig of lights, and we used all of those as much as we could. And the audience was primarily younger, made up of fellow students of the contemporaries of the cast and the cast parents and families. So they were really on board. But I remember those going really well and being really sort of, yeah, lots of appreciative warm laughter and a good vibe. And especially the second performance, where I made the sensible decision to put in an interval, which I should have done in the first performance, but I did not, because I think still thought I was Katie Mitchell. And then in the second performance, I was like, no, let's put in an interval. Let's stop being cruel to everyone. And the audience much preferred that. And then we performed at Queen's College, Cambridge. And we didn't have much time to get to know that space at all, but we had the balcony, which I gather sometimes the choir sing off this balcony in this college. And so we would sometimes stick actors up there, and that was quite fun because they had no time to figure out how to get up there, run up there, no idea about how the acoustics would sound. But it all worked really well because the acoustics in those spaces are lovely. And the only slight inconvenience, which we turned to our advantage, was that a bell would toll every 15 minutes. And whenever the bell tolled, the cast would just all hold their hands up and pause as if they were sort of summoning gods, and it was just a game that we evolved, and we just decided that we couldn't pretend it wasn't happening, and it would always happen in the middle of some dialogue where it had nothing to do with bells tolling. So it just became this mad immersive joke that the audience, I think, fully got on board with. And on the walls there were these ancient crests, something to do with the college's history, but there were loads of crests on one of the walls. And I remember the actress Kathy playing Pacifilo referencing those, like she integrated the space really well. There was a bit where she was talking about someone's ancient lineage, and she used the walls to imply that they had all these crests as part of their lineage. But I would say in some ways the best and the worst performances were the third round at the Oxford College, where it was half al fresco, half indoors. I think Rihanna's really described it very well, the extent to which this show is kind of custom built to be a distraction, to be in the way, to be a bunch of physical japes and a bunch of characters who you kind of half listen to, who you kind of half recognise whilst you're having a drink and having a laugh with your mates. And I think that the show really came into its own there. Outdoors, yeah, people were drinking and people were kind of sussing what the plot was, and that was fine. And then we had an hour-long break as a cast while they had however many courses. And as a cast, we all just went completely mad in this tiny little room which we've been given by the college. This little like student room where we kind of sat eating like Wagamama food and chatting and trying not to be nervous about the second act. It was so odd to have such a long gap. And then we went in and performed in the dining hall, and they were all like half drunk by this point, but all the audience, as you would expect. And it was brilliant. And the cast instantly caught that energy, and they did things they'd never done before. They were really interacting with the audience. They were roaming all over the place, yelling over tables, standing on chairs, clambering over everything. Things that we hadn't had time to rehearse just kind of came to them, and the audience was getting involved. Like I think that there was a bit where someone put their hat on an audience member's head and they loved that, and the audience would like tap the cast on the back if they walked past, and that show ended with an enormous standing ovation. Everyone, all these drunk American international students, went mad and stood up and clapped at the end, and it was quite overwhelming. And I think it was because we'd created with them an event. Everyone had participated in the event. Maybe some of the story had been lost, maybe some of the fine details, but it was a raucous affair, and that felt like very true to the play as well, in a way.
Mm. Yes. Oh, because let's not pretend that Inns of Court drama was potentially anything less than very raucous, especially with a play like this. So winding down now, as we that performance goes into the past. Go to Rihanna just on the difference between that show that you performed and your initial first impressions of that, and any final takeaways about that experience doing that that play.
Yeah, well, what Sam's just described of the raucous event that was the Oxford performance, that's definitely the kind of place that where that show is held in my memory, rather than in the kind of scary looking fat text that we were given to begin with. Crucially for me, I think changing the setting to the 1950s and through the process of performing it in a kind of interactive way with the audience in different settings gave us a journey with our characters so much that the kind of the Quentin Quincy character that I created feels potentially so different to the Cleander that somebody else might create from looking at the script at a first glance and interpreting it in their own way. And it felt like a unique thing that we together as a cast, as with any show you create, you know, it was specific to that mix of people, and it was bizarre and zany and fun. And you know, the bits that I remember most are the characters that we created. Like, we had, I can't remember the official name, but Auntie Trish with her knitting, which was played by Josh. So she was this like cross-dressed old hag, and the knitting, she got all caught up in it, and topless Josh as Ted, who was the Cambridge salesman with his bike, and the kind of physical gags that we created that obviously helped tell the story of the text. But personally, that's more fun to play in the moment, and you've got more leverage over that with an audience and when it's live, which is what the fun of performing that play was for me. And I guess that, from first glance, you never know really what it's going to turn into. So it's nice to know that we did something completely different with it that another group potentially wouldn't have.
And which was recorded and put online. Which day, which show was that a recording of?
The online show is the second performance at the second and last performance at the actual theatre venue, the Mumford Theatre. Mm-hmm. So but there is also a documentary called Performing Supposes, which is on Vimeo, which has clips of all the performances in it, just to give you a flavour, and that's quite nice. The cast say lots of nice things in that. And also, just to say, you've reminded me, yeah, so that Auntie Trish is this character, the old hag, a friend of Bally the nurse. She's actually called Citeria, or Citeria in the original text. You just reminded me how just giving someone who can't knit a massive bundle of pink wool and two knitting needles and go, you have to knit like mad, produces brilliant physical comedy. It just wrote itself.
Well, links to everything will be on in the show notes. The video that exists on YouTube is a single locked off camera, but it is clear and it exists. You know, you can't expect us to produce NT live for you people, you know, but this was years ago, you know, in the before times of 2017. But it does exist, and it is a lovely thing. And also we'll put in links for the Performing Supposes as well. Do you have any future hopes or dreams at the moment, as performers, as directors, as artists going forward? Are there any projects that you'd like to do within the world of what we do here? Of plays written before 1642, with a few exceptions, or any projects that you have coming up that you're hoping, you know, the world will open out and we'll be able to do things again, you know, in the same room.
Oh, well, I mean, one thing we haven't touched on, so this is a great point to crowbar it in, is that Supposes is a play that has lots of opportunities for improvisation. There are a couple of moments where there's the kind of stage direction, etc., in a line. And so Cleander seems to have an opportunity to improvise a little speech, which always changed every night with us. And there's at least one other moment of that in the text, and probably more. I continue to pursue an avid interest in improv, you'll be pleased to hear, Rob. I've started a new improv troupe of sick formers called Babblers, who are an offshoot of my company, Babylon Theatre. And Babblers will, from September, perform every Monday in the Robinson Theatre during term time for like £3 a ticket, which is hopefully going to turn the Robinson Theatre in Cambridge into a nice improv hub for young people, which would be really cool. So I'd love to do more stuff involving improv and these early texts, because I think there's lots to be done there. That's me.
As a performer and a creator, I tend to have an interest in kind of everything. I like to flit around. Would love to work on a text like this again and kind of go through that process of being intimidated by it and then finding a way with it. Because that always feels nice when you feel like you've got a hand around the text. yeah, in my own kind of personal pursuits, certainly initially introduced by Sam, but I've always had a love for clowning and a while ago created a two-woman show with my friend. If anyone wants some silly social media content, because that's kind of the extent of what we're producing at the moment, but obviously there's hope for future performances. We are Those People Theatre on Instagram, and we don't have any content in terms of our performances up online, but we might look into doing that soon, and we'll definitely be trying to get out there as soon as possible. End sentence.
and you're in training at the moment, aren't you, Rihanna? Rihanna's currently in training at East 15 and developing in many ways as a young performer.
Thank you.
That is sadly all we have time for. Any useful links will be in the show notes so that you can follow our journey with Supposes. It is a super fun play. We recommend it to the house. If you're an aspiring director, actor, performer, any kind of theatre person, and you want a rollicking good comedy, then we recommend for you the play Supposes. It may be hard work to read it initially, but stick with it because it yields gems. Thanks very much to today's interviewees, Sam and Rihanna. Thank you very much, everyone, and goodbye.